Okay, well, we'll just we'll dive right in. My name is Jeremy Myers. I am on the religion faculty at Augsburg College in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I oversee their youth and family ministry major. So I get to teach general religion classes as well as youth ministry classes. And was really, 15 years ago, I was here at in the village running the Myers Junior Myers program. The summer after I graduated college. So it's kind of neat to be back here now in this role. Having spent the last... I would even probably say it was a teenager in the village who called me into youth ministry. On the bus, they probably still do this today. We take the kids down to the lake to swim.
I do Narnia, but yeah, they okay, go down. Yeah,
go down to swim, and we were coming back up on a school bus, and this was the day before I was going to leave the village and go back to Minnesota, and I didn't know what I'd be doing when I got back there. And this one teenager was saying, well, what are you going to do when you get back? I have no idea. Just try and find a job. Well, what kind of job? I have no idea. And he said, well, you should be the youth minister at our church. We're looking for someone. And I had never really thought about that. And he said, no, he wouldn't let me off the bus, the big guy, much bigger than I was. And he wouldn't let me off the bus. And he said, I'm not going to let you off the bus until you promise to at least talk to the pastor at the church. Fine. And I made a promise. I said, I'll give the pastor a call. And when I got home, I did call the pastor and went and met with him and actually really liked the pastor and liked the way they were talking about the job description and took the job. And 15 years later, here I am, back.
What church was it?
St. Philip's in Fridley. So I served that church for a few years and then served in Valparaiso, Indiana for a few years, and now I teach.
Are you nervous at all that these 2 weeks could lead to a new job proposal?
No. I hadn't thought about that. And I'm here with my wife, Tracy, and our two little kids. Elijah is 9 and Naima is 5. So you'll see them running around. They're fun. They'll ignore you if you try and talk to them. I apologize for that. That's just the way they are. So what I really want to talk about this week is, this is really new stuff I've been thinking about. I've not taught any of this yet. So you're guinea pigs. And I'm really excited to try and get this to a place where we can have conversation and I can glean wisdom from you folks as well. About this topic, but the idea really is public church and youth ministry. Many people are concerned about young people and faith and the church and the future of the church, and essentially the argument that I want to make in these sessions is that what young people need is a church that's willing to be public about their faith in constructive ways, in constructive, meaningful ways for the context in which they're situated. So young people need a community of, an intergenerational community of people working to find ways to proclaim good news, to proclaim incarnation as it happens out in the world. So a group of people who goes looking for the incarnation, rather than thinking that they own it in their own building, and people need to come there to hear about it. So that's what I hope I'll be hope to talk about this week. There's some theoretical stuff I want to cover really quickly, and then we'll get into the practices of how I think this might happen. I would say so. There's two big cultural events that have happened in history that I think lead to this need to talk about youth in public church. One would be first the privatization of religion, this idea that religion is only a personal thing and not a public thing. This idea that it's only about you and your own personal salvation and not about something more public than that. All right, that in the history of humankind, that's a rather recent phenomenon. The other cultural event really is this emergence of adolescence, which the whole idea of adolescence as a particular unique life phase is only 100 years old or so. But yet, we tend to think about the realities of childhood and adolescence as just givens, things that cannot be changed. Oh, they're just a bundle of hormones. Oh, that's just the way they are. We do this all the time in the church. So adolescence really kind of emerged at a time when religion was becoming more and more privatized, more and more private in America. Adolescence was emerging. So adolescence then, the way the church then started to work with young people really revolved more around this private understanding of the human being and this private understanding of religion and this narrow understanding of adolescence as a unique life phase. Okay, so the church, I think, the church now, it has become somewhat critical of private religion, and the church is now starting to talk about the public communal expression of faith. But the one thing we have not done is we have not questioned the way we think about the young person, this private way of understanding the young person, if that makes sense. So the whole idea of adolescence grew up, pun intended, during a time when where we were thinking about the individual in very private, personal ways. So what I would say the antidote would be a vocational understanding of adolescence. So not just thinking about the young person biologically, right, as a bunch of unique chemical reactions, and not just understanding the adolescent culturally as a lump of clay or a blank slate waiting to be shaped and molded, but also understanding the adolescent vocationally, so that culture and biology are not the only things that influence, that have agency in the life of a young person, but that God's Spirit is also doing something to that young person. So how then does a faith community, how would that change the way we think about the young person if we, sure, there's all the changes that go on with puberty, right? But we also think God's Spirit is doing something there, right? We also think that there's the gift of wisdom being given there, the gift of compassion being given there. And so how might we start to think about the young person vocationally rather than just culturally or biologically? The flip side of that, so vocation is to the adolescent as public church is to religion. So then how might we start to think about our faith communities also as communities that have been that are called out of themselves? So young people are not, we often think of the young person as this self-centered ego maniac that's completely concerned about finding his or her own identity, right? Well, that's I think a really short-sighted way to explain their lived experience, because many of them aren't thinking about who am I and what's my identity. Many young people are thinking about how do I fit into this world, right? So it's not about me in this cloister figuring out myself, but it's about me in this world, in this community, and what's my purpose and what's my meaning and how do I find that and how do I make a difference and how do I help make this world a better place. But we often think, oh, they're just worried about themselves and finding their own identity. So the first thing we need to do is really force ourselves outside of those two frameworks and into these two frameworks. And I'm happy to talk more about those around the village. But what I really want to do is get to the practices that we're here to talk about. So the way I would, this is the way I'm defining public youth ministry right now. It's an intergenerational faith community seeking to engage its context, its community, its neighborhood, its location, and express its faith in both public and constructive ways. There's a lot of public religion right now, but it's not necessarily constructive. So how can it become public and constructive. And most importantly, for the neighbor. How can our churches intentionally exist for the neighbor? How can we give ourselves away? How can we exist for the neighbor, for the sake of the neighbor, for the sake of our young people? So that they too might learn how to exist for the sake of the neighbor. Because that's what they're yearning for. They're longing to know, how do I live for the sake of my neighbor? So I would say there are five art forms that enable a community to do this. And I call them art forms. I've been saying practices. But I like the idea of art form better because, you know, if you paint, there's lots of ways to paint, right? So it just, to me, sounds a little more fluid and open and less certain. but these are the five art forms: accompaniment, biblical imagination, reflective practice, contemplation, and ritualizing. Each session this week will focus on a different one of these. So tonight we're going to be talking about accompaniment. There are lots of different ways communities will do this, and I'm not here to tell people how they do it. I just want to tell them that they probably should figure out ways to do this. But we will look at some ideas as well. I was reading Jaber Crow. Has anyone read Jaber Crow or anything else by Wendell Berry? So I was reading Jaber Crow a couple weeks ago, and Jaber Crow is this novel by Wendell Berry. The main character, Jaber Crow, is the town barber who spends most of his day observing the town. It's a wonderful story. He's a wonderful character. But at the beginning of the book, there's this great description. So here I'm reading Jaber Crow, thinking about these sessions, and Jaber's describing the school in the community. And I couldn't help read his description of the school without thinking about it as a description of church. So wherever you see church underlined in bold print, Barry would have said school there. Okay, so I just pulled school out and put church in. So let me read this to you. To walk past the church while it was in session was like coming near a sleeping large animal. You could hear the enclosed murmurs and rustlings of an intense inward life. Belonging, it seemed, to another world, whose absence from the town made it seem otherworldly. While the children were in church, the town seemed abnormally quiet. The quiet by mid-afternoon would sometimes seem almost entranced. And so I loved especially the time of day when church let out. What the will of the neighborhood had managed to pen up all day in something like order would all of a sudden burst loose and stream out both ways along the road. So, I like that because I think school and church has worked really hard to create some type of order when it comes to our kids and our young people. And in the process of that, we've put them to sleep. We've created a sleeping animal. And so how then do we exist as a church that actually sends them running and screaming with joy or passion or whatever it might be through the streets? So that's really the image I want to be working with here as we talk about this. Another story is the text for the theme this summer, the Ezekiel text. And I will be using bits and pieces of this chapter throughout the week. So these are just the first few verses. Let me read these to you, and then I'll try to explain how they work. Then he brought, and this, by the way, this picture in the back is a painting of this text from some community, religious, a community that's focuses religion and art. And I just like the way it depicts the story. I also like it because I think my profile is kind of like that guy's profile. Then he brought me back to the entrance of the temple. There, water was flowing from below the threshold of the temple towards the east, for the temple faced east. And the water was flowing down from below the south end of the threshold of the temple, south of the altar. Then he brought me out by way of the north gate and led me round on the outside to the outer gate that faces towards the east, and the water was coming out on the south side. Going on eastwards with a cord in his hand, the man measured 1,000 cubits, and then led me through the water, and it was ankle deep. Again, he measured 1,000 cubits and led me through the water, and it was knee deep. Again, he measured 1,000 cubits and led me through the water, and it was up to the waist. Again, he measured 1,000, and it was a river that I could not cross, for the water had risen. It was deep enough to swim in, a river that could not be crossed. He said to me, "Mortal, have you seen this?" I love that line. "Mortal, have you seen this?" And this is why I love the line. What's going on here? What's happening to the water here? What's happening to the water in this text?
It's increasing in depth.
Yes, exactly. It's
flowable.
Yes, it's getting more powerful. It's getting deeper. It's getting wider.
Yeah.
The further it flows from the temple. The further the water flows from the temple, the wider it gets, the deeper it gets, the more powerful it gets. If you were in Bible study this morning, any of you in the Bible, what is the water? How are they thinking about water at this time? Remember that conversation this morning in the Bible study?
Presence of God.
Yeah, so this is God's law, God's mercy, the presence of God, right? So here we're being led along the river, and then we're being turned to, and we're being asked a very simple question. Do you see this? So what is that question? What is being said here? God's grace, God's mercy flows deeply, flows freely, flows powerfully, where we don't necessarily control it.
Well, and also I can't help make the association with what you're arguing, Jeremy, that we ordinarily think that the deepest presence of God is at church or at the temple, and the text, like what you're doing, flips that.
Right.
Which is beautiful.
Yeah, I did some research a few years ago on religious experiences among young people, and none of them talked about church. But they used sacramental language. They talked about reconciliation, redemption. They talked about vocation. They talked about service. All of these things we would want to hear them say. We would be very proud to hear them say, but none of them said anything about Word and Sacrament ministry the way we traditionally think about it in church. But I definitely heard them talking about hearing God's word proclaimed. And I definitely heard them talking about having sacramental experiences, but not in worship. Some up here at Olden Village, actually, I heard stories about. So we're talking about accompaniment. Anyone a musician? Yes, I mean, most musicians say, all right, see, there's a problem, musician. You raised your hand. Yes, I am. And so have you accompanied people before? Choirs?
Yes.
Or?
Yeah, choir.
So what does it mean if you're a musician and you accompany a group? How is that different than just playing a solo? What does it take to actually be an accompanist?
You have to listen to what they're doing and fit in with what the other person's doing.
Okay, so you have to listen to what they're doing and fit it in with what they're doing.
Yeah.
Okay, Chris, were you gonna?
No, sorry, I was just pulling my sleeve up.
That's all right, you can do that.
We just have to be very attentive to what's going on.
Sure.
In general.
Yep.
It's an ensemble. Right?
Sure.
And so you embellish or work with the soloist.
Sure.
But you don't overpower. Or sometimes you take turns. But
sure,
but
you might.
Primarily, it's to hold up or back up.
Sure. So then how might we transfer that metaphor, let's use that now as a metaphor, to talk about a human relationship? So what then does it mean to accompany another person?
To walk alongside.
Okay. And what else? In what ways, given what we just talked about accompanying someone musically? To walk alongside, but also to, what is it?
To listen.
You have to listen to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you have to pull back, right? So, okay, so now let's transfer that from the human relationship to, let's talk about communities. What would that mean then for a congregation to accompany its community?
Not the congregation as community, but the community around the congregation.
Great question,
right.
Yes.
Yeah, is that where, yeah, yeah. That's where you're at.
Yeah. Yeah. What would it mean for the congregation to accompany its neighborhood, if that helps?
Go out and listen to them.
Yeah. Go out and listen to them. Know them. The church for a long time has existed as a beat, you know, as the church has existed for quite some time thinking of itself as a beacon of hope, right? If we burn bright enough, everyone will come. That ain't the case.
If
we build it, they will come, right? It's just, and It's just not the case anymore. So then how then, and I've seen this in urban congregations. I've seen urban congregations and rural congregations, some rural congregations, but in my context, I seem to know rural churches better, that have done this very well, accompanying their neighborhoods very well, because they have to. It's sort of a life and death thing. They'll die out. They'll have to close their doors if they don't figure this out. So they talk about this type of ministry as a necessity, but the way I want to talk about it is maybe the way ministry should just be done, period, anywhere. So this is what we'll be talking about. I believe a church that can find meaningful ways to accompany its context, its community, its neighborhood, and if they can find meaningful ways to do that with their young people, I believe they will have a vibrant community of young people actively engaged in what the church is doing. I remember taking a group of young people I worked with at one of my churches to a poor part of town, and this was a smaller town, and some of them said, I never knew this part of town existed. Mm-hmm. I won't name any names.
Or you're in that area.
Or I was always told not to come over here.
Yeah, right.
That's
yeah.
The other one.
Yeah, I was told, yeah. Or I didn't know this existed in our town.
But that's the neighborhood you don't.
Right, but the flip side of that is, the other reality is once you start exploring your community, places where you thought were the places you didn't want to go, you start to go there and you realize there's pure joy here too, right? This is not just poverty, but there's joy here, there's gifted people here, there's powerful community here that maybe the church could actually learn from. So that's what it means to accompany, to listen, that this is not about me. This is about us, and how do I accompany you and make you better, and learn from you? So, quickly, why do I think this is important? Theologically, there's sort of this stream that I'm following that really starts with the belief and hope and trust in the incarnation. That God shows up in a particular place. So it's not what we're talking about. Accompaniment is not. What am I trying to say? It's not just contextual. It's incarnational. By that I mean that it comes from somewhere else, right? So there's a no to it. That it comes from somewhere else. So there, it's different than the context. It's larger than the context. It transcends the context, but at the same time, it affirms the context because it shows up there. Does that make sense? So there's this understanding of the incarnation, that God shows up in places. That leads to this understanding of vocation, that God shows up in places, and God calls me to those places. And then the third step is this idea of discipleship, that God shows up in places and God calls me to these places And discipleship then is clinging to Christ as Christ drags me to these places. You know, I think of little children when they sit on your feet and wrap their arms around your legs. You've probably all experienced that, right? And you walk around with little kids on your feet. That's kind of my image of discipleship, right? We're just clinging to Christ as Christ walks into these places of brokenness and suffering, and we find ourselves there with Christ. So it's this God showing up, God calling us to these places. Discipleship then is us learning how to be in those places with Christ, and teaching our young people that as well. So how do we raise young people into faith? We go into those places with Christ. We as a community ask ourselves Bonhoeffer's questions. Who is Christ for us today? And to whom is Christ calling me? And we just ask those questions. We respond. We act on those responses. And then we ask those questions again. Who is Christ for us now? And to whom is Christ calling us now? Rather than, I mean, the way a lot of youth ministry works now is curriculum-driven and program-driven. So we plan it all out, and then we do it. And I guess what I'm saying is, rather than having it so planned out, how do we just go and listen and respond? How do we go and look for these places of incarnation? How do we listen for the call of vocation? That process of looking for and proclaiming incarnation and listening for vocation, that process of doing that as a community is discipleship. And then the theoretical reason for doing this really would be just the educational theories of experiential and popular education. So kids learn best by doing it, right? So how do we do discipleship? How do we teach discipleship? We live it. We do it. We go out there. We listen. We look for incarnation. We proclaim incarnation. And then the practical reason for doing this is just way more interesting. It's a lot more fun than sitting in your office planning, or sitting in the, anyone ever sit on a youth committee, youth council? It's a lot more fun than sitting on a youth committee. It's more fun. I'm biased. But. So now I want to talk about some specific practices, some specific ways you can practice this art form. And one is, and this is not rocket science, and it's not a silver bullet, but they are interesting to do, and every time I've done them, I'm just amazed at what young people see and find. One simple thing to do is a prayer walk, or what has also been called asset mapping. Anyone ever done anything like this? What was your experience like? What was it?
Unbelievable healing.
Okay.
It's amazing.
Great. And you?
For a prayer walk?
Yeah, or, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What I found was that the young people were much more, we went and on a walk and stopped to pray every so often. Is that what you call
sure.
prayer walk?
We
didn't do asset mapping, we did a
prayer walk. Okay, yeah, this is a little different than that.
And the young people were... They're much more anxious to do the praying than the adults.
Were they really?
Yes.
Great.
Yeah, they
Chris, were you pushing your sleeve up, or did you have...
No, my friend in New York does what he calls pray and break bread. Mm-hmm. And so we adopted that practice at Luther my second year, and a group of students and I went to different neighborhoods where we were hosted by a congregation, and we learned about what they knew about the neighborhood and how they engaged the neighborhood, and then we went and walked around the neighborhood praying for the neighborhood, and then ended up at a local restaurant in the neighborhood to eat together.
Great, yeah.
And we did some statistics beforehand just to get a kind of census level view of the neighborhood, mm-hmm. but then balanced that against the experiences that we had meeting people and eating with people in the neighborhood.
Yeah. We've done this with I've done this with students of mine at Augsburg, and so these are third, fourth year students. When I do this with them, they've been in this community for that many years, and we do a prayer walk through the neighborhood, And they see things they never knew were there. And they've walked through that neighborhood for years now, and they see things they never knew they would, that was there. They notice there's bike shops around the neighborhood, and you go, there's these high-rises near Augsburg, low-income high-rises. You walk past those high-rises, and I say, look up on the balcony, and they look up on the balcony, and I say, what do you see on almost every balcony? A kid's bike, right? Okay, so this neighborhood's full of kids with bikes, and there's bike shops here. What can be done with them? So we try and get them to start to look at the neighborhood as this place that's living, right? So this is just one way to do that. You gather your congregation or whoever's going to do this walk with you. And this is the hard part, identify your community. We did this with a bunch of churches, and one church was out in the suburbs, and they couldn't identify, even beyond the suburbs, really borderline rural, they couldn't map their community. They just couldn't figure it out. I'm like, well, who's your neighbor? And they're like, well, Prince, the musician. I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? Like, our church is right next to Prince's recording studio. So if you go down there, there's their church, and right next to their church is Prince's recording studio. So we had to kind of work with them to map their community a little more broadly. So you gather your congregation, you identify your community. What's our area that we're really talking about, that we serve? You know, kind of going back to the old parish way of understanding church. And then the next thing you do as a group, and I'll talk about this later in the week too when I talk about contemplation and spiritual practices, but this is essentially the spiritual practice of the awareness examen, if any of you have done that, where you practice looking for places of hope and places of suffering, places of life, places of death, and you learn how to identify those places and name those places, and then you go out actually looking for those places. You assign zones, or you just walk the entire community if you can. If you have a big group in a big area, you might assign different groups to different zones and send them out looking for places of hope, places of suffering. However your community wants to frame that question really is fine. I think the important piece is that you look for both. You know, look for both places of life and places of suffering. Look for both. Because we tend to only go looking for one or the other. You note those places, and you listen to what you hear from people as you encounter them throughout the community. So young, you know, I did this with one group of people who really kind of fixated on, this was a rural group, but they fixated on their own congregational property and the fact that their community had no gathering place. So they actually got a grant from the Minnesota Twins. This was youth who did this, who initiated this. In rural Minnesota, got a grant from the Minnesota Twins to build a softball field on their church property and a picnic pavilion so that their small rural community had a public place to gather. They didn't have anything like that. This was a group of high school kids who made this happen for their entire, and a church that did this for their community by listening. And then you start talking about, where are these places where we saw Christ show up? Where are these places where we feel deeply called? Where are we being called as a community? It's not rocket science. It's not a magic bullet, but it's the process of discipleship. It's the process of living as a community, wondering what is Christ up to here, and how might we participate with Christ in that. By doing that as a community, we are doing discipleship. We are teaching our young people how to live the life of faith. That is the life of faith. Christ. Who is Christ for me today? Who is Christ calling me to today? That's the life of faith. Those are the questions you and I ask, I would say, probably on a daily basis. Another example. So that's the neighborhood prayer walk, where you don't necessarily walk and pray for the neighborhood, but you prayerfully walk through the neighborhood looking for places of life and death. Another example, a few years ago, I was working on the curriculum for the National Youth Gathering, which we were just talking about, for the last National Youth Gathering that was in New Orleans. So I was spending some time in New Orleans trying to talk to as many people from New Orleans as possible, basically saying, okay, I've been given the task of getting 35,000 people ready to be in New Orleans and be helpful and not be in your way. So what should I be doing in this curriculum to get these people ready? And these people said, just tell them to come and listen to our stories. You know, but then when I asked a group of youth, what do you want to do when you're in New Orleans? They're like, I want to put a roof on every house. You know? But the people who don't have roofs in New Orleans say, just come and listen to my story. They weren't saying, come and put a roof on my house. They were saying, just have a glass of lemonade with me in the shade, and let me tell you our story about Hurricane Katrina and the flood that came afterward. So out of that reality grew, this is not anything I'm associated with, I just learned about this project, the Neighborhood Story Project, based in New Orleans. But a group of young people started working with the neighborhoods to write their own neighborhood stories, to write write down essentially the oral tradition, to get the oral tradition down into books. And I thought, wouldn't that be an amazing thing for a congregation to do with its own community? How might the congregation help the community start to know its own story and tell its own story? And in doing that, I think the congregation, theologically, might start to find moments and places of incarnation that we can then name as such and point out as such. So this is another interesting project that I think is worth people looking at. And then some examples of places that I know of that have done this is Redeemer Lutheran Church in North Minneapolis. They did a campaign of intentional listening where they went to neighborhood meetings. They walked around the neighborhood. They interviewed business owners. They interviewed residents. To try and figure out what the community really needed. And they found three themes, really. Jobs. The community said, we need jobs here in the neighborhood. We need something for our youth. And we need housing. And so that church now has started lots of things. They own an apartment complex that they built, that they manage, that has public space downstairs for people to come and use the computers to look for jobs. They do a lot of really creative, innovative youth work in the community. They started a bike shop that teaches young people, apprentices young people in bike repair, so that a young person from the neighborhood can go through a training program and get certified as a bike mechanic at this bike shop that the church started. Then they can go to any bike shop anywhere and be certified, and they can show them that certificate, and the bike shop will know they're qualified, and that'll help them get a job. So it was an intentional effort on the part of the congregation to go listen to their community. Another congregation in St. Paul, St. Timothy in St. Paul. This is not anything earth-shattering, but a few people from the congregation went to the local elementary school the day before they were going to be doing their standardized tests this spring, and met with a group of students that had been identified by the faculty as borderline students, students who are good students but might not test well. And the pastor and two of the members from the church went and spent an hour or two with these kids talking about anxiety and failure and redemption, though they probably didn't use that language. But they just spent a couple hours helping these kids sort of process their anxiety around these tests. Not anything earth-shattering, wasn't going to bring in a whole stream of new members to the congregation, right? And then another project out in the suburbs, another church did a listening project similar to what Redeemer did, and what they heard was that there was sort of underground, unknown homeless issue among teenagers in the suburbs, and they didn't have access to as many services as teens who were homeless in the city. It was easier for a homeless teen in the city to find services not so easy if you're homeless in the suburbs, and there were a lot of kids homeless in the suburbs. So they created, this congregation with other congregations worked to support a staff person who created a suburban host home program for teens who are homeless. Other ideas that you guys, other ways you've heard this happen? Things you've heard of? Yeah.
Well, in our church, Emmanuel and Puyallup, Washington here, we didn't do as thorough of a job, I think, for having the youth go out and walk the community to look for these, but leadership and staff found places of service, and then the entire congregation, twice a year, takes the whole weekend, Saturday and including Sunday morning, to be out there doing projects in the community that are needed. And youth and adults all together with the projects. And then Saturday or Sunday afternoon, we have a big rally service and some reporting about what we were doing. And that's been very good.
Yeah, yeah. So the congregation does that together.
Yeah.
And then celebrates it as well.
Yeah.
Which is another piece we'll talk about later in the week. Celebration, ritualizing, marking these significant events and moments that happen. Are there other ways you've seen this happen?
Well, I haven't thought about it exactly in this context, but this past year our congregation decided to have its own booth at the Twin Cities Gay Pride Festival. We have a large task force, very concerned about the marriage of Edmund County, Minnesota. And I think that was people really stepped up to sign up for shifts there. And I think it was because they understood the importance of this in our community context to really make a witness.
Mm-hmm.
And
how are young people?
And families with kids signed up to be there. Mm-hmm. And they really want their kids to have that experience too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Young people are waiting for the church to publicly take a stance on many, 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 many issues. Regardless of where the young person, regardless of how the young person thinks about that issue, they're just sitting there waiting for their churches to take a stance, to say something. Here's what I'd like to do, just to kind of wrap it up. Find two people. So there's three of you. Okay? And in the group of three, talk a little bit about how might you see your congregation at home start to practice accompaniment with youth, intergenerationally, with young people. How might your congregation at home begin to engage young people in this practice of accompanying their community, their context, engaging their community, learning about their community, lifting up their community. So take some time with a few people you're sitting next to and just brainstorm some ideas. How might you see this happening in your own congregation? Okay. Why don't we come back together? I hope you'll keep thinking about this. If you're from the Midwest, you have a long way home, and maybe that'll buy you some time to think more about this. If you're not from the Midwest, find another. Come to the Midwest so you have time to think about it. quickly, as a group, let's talk about two things. First, I want you to let's just talk about assets. All right. So, what are the things your home congregation? You talked a little bit about how you might actually see this happening in your home congregation. What are the things in your home congregation that might enable this, that might actually really help make this happen? What are some of those things?
Well, the adults, kids, and parents of kids at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Rochester, Minnesota. We go about four or five times a year to serve, to prepare and serve a meal for quite a number of them are homeless at Christ United Methodist Church. And I think it's really a key thing. It's an important thing that if there is a structure in the community mm-hmm. to make the most of that,
sure.
you don't have to crank up another another structure
yes.
And make it better just because your church is involved.
Sure. Sure.
And that's just, and the confirmation kids have, I think, probably a certain number of hours to do public stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, you see, two, three kids and their parents down there doing it.
Yes.
It's just a good thing.
So there's already a culture there,
sure.
and there's already a system there that
sure.
allows for some of that.
Sure.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes the asset is location, the old real estate mantra. And
sure.
we're fortunate at St. Church and Puyallup, that Deb was talking about, where we now have opened a coffee shop
mm-hmm.
directly across from the high school.
Great.
So there we are. And now the doors are open. It's flowing out
yep.
out of the sanctuary
yep.
and into the coffee shop, where kids are more likely to feel comfortable
yep.
just checking it out.
Yeah, they might come over after school for a
right.
mocha or something, but they won't come into the church for a track,
right?
Right.
right.
Yeah. Yeah, Jeff.
Sounds kind of like an obvious one, but I think worship, we
sure.
should name as an asset.
Yeah.
Especially if youth are, I mean, encouraged to be present and kind of engaged in the proclamation of the gospel and in that story and in hearing it faithfully, I think that is compelling to anyone
mm-hmm.
and to create a worship climate where all are welcome into that and a variety of different gifts are used, and that's a good place to start.
Yeah, I agree. But I also think it's going to take communities to reclaim worship as a public
mm-hmm.
thing. Because really, if you think about it, the most public thing a church does is worship, right? Because anyone really can show up there, even though many people don't feel comfortable going there. But it really is probably the most public thing that any church does is worship. So then how do we think of it that way and talk about it that way and really approach worship as something that is intended to be the work of the people, that is intended to be public?
About, I think, 8 years ago now, I did junior-senior high youth ministry,
mm-hmm.
and we struggled with enthusiasm, so we identified our community and invited other denominations within our community to come together
mm-hmm.
and create some of that enthusiasm by, you know, new energy, new people,
mm-hmm.
and we would go out and do things together
great.
That way.
Great, yeah. Yeah, Martin Marty writes a lot about public church, and the way he writes about it really is reviving an ecumenical spirit. You know, like the church, the one way the church could be more public is by being more ecumenical. Yeah.
Is there a similar push in that direction towards interfaith, or has that been pursued?
Well, this is. It's becoming, yes, I would say. Really interesting, so when Martin Marty was writing about this in the 80s, he was writing about public church as being ecumenical in the 80s, but he was saying by the turn of the century, we're going to be talking about this as interfaith. So he was, you know, 20 years kind of ahead of his time pointing in that direction. So, yeah, public church now is, and again, depending on your location, right? Public church... I'm thinking about my experience at Augsburg College, and I would say Augsburg is really even trying to figure out how a private college of the ELCA can be a public institution. How can we give ourselves away? And it's very much, given our context, forcing the interfaith conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So let me just end with this. It's not just about creating service projects for young people. It's about teaching young people how to go out into their context and find those places of incarnation and to celebrate those, to find those places where Christ is present, to name it as such, to find those places of brokenness, of fear, and find a way to speak a word of hope into those places. So not just saying, here, I've created a service project for you. Because then we just teach them how to do what we're telling them to do. I'm telling you to go do this service project. But what we want are young people who are out in the world saying, we need to do something about this over here, folks, right? So how do we raise up people of faith who can do that? Who can say, hey, look over here, right? And who can listen to the gifts of the community, like the people in New Orleans were basically saying, you know, we don't need your gifts, we don't need your money, and they weren't being, you know, rude about it. They were saying, just come and listen to what we have. You know, we have gifts to give too. So it's teaching them how to accompany a community. As the church can learn how to do this, I think young people will start to. Be excited about their faith communities once again. We'll end there. Vespers is in 15 minutes, right?
Yep.
Okay, thank you. I'll stick around for a few minutes and I'm happy to chat a little bit more if you'd like. But thank you, guys.